Hi, everyone. I'm Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. And the first thing that I want to do tonight is welcome everyone here to Utah. We're happy to have you, and it's an exciting thing for all of the committee that's been putting it on and for the community to have y'all here, so give yourself a hand. They said I have an hour, and I have a really bad voice, I think you can tell. I sound like somebody's little brother, but I caught a cold a couple of weeks ago, and so forgive me for the way I sound, and I'll try to do my best. If I start coughing, you can throw me out. Whoops. The first thing maybe I need to do is explain to you, she introduced me as the trustee at large. I wish that I were the trustee at large. I was nominated from the state to be the trustee at large. However, Larry Nelson from San Diego Imperial was elected 2 years ago for that position. And he's doing a wonderful, wonderful job for Alcoholics Anonymous overseas. And I'm proud of Larry being elected. After that election, I was appointed to the trustees CPC committee. And so I do have the privilege of being in New York and working on a quarterly basis with the committees. And I truly love it. I just, it's like a dream come true. And after I start telling you a little bit about what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now, you're going to wonder, what in the heck are they putting somebody like that in New York for? But I try to be good while I'm there. You know, I know that y'all have really big expectations, and I do too for this weekend. But just for this hour, I have a little favor that I want to ask of you. In fact, I have a bumper sticker, and it says, "Blessed are those who expect nothing, for they shall not be disappointed." So just keep your expectations down, and I'm going to be okay. I have a little piece of paper here. My husband said, for crying out loud, don't get too maudlin, tell him a joke. So I have 3 jokes, you guys. And if you start falling asleep, just let me know and I'll tell one of them. And that was the first one, the low expectations. It's got to get better. Marcy just asked if she could tell you, but she didn't. And so I have to tell you, I really appreciate y'all coming here to celebrate my birthday with me. Yesterday celebrated my 25th anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I just can't hardly even believe that. When I came into this program, I didn't even think I wanted to stay sober for 25 minutes for sure. And I'm just so happy today. My whole life has changed as a result of this program. I grew up in Utah, and I've always lived here. So I've been really, you know, kind of a backward little kid. And I grew up in Ogden Canyon, which was a place where I was alone a lot. And I played mostly with the animals played in the snow and in the river. And so I was really kind of a loner from the time I was a little kid. My folks were of the predominant religion in Utah, and they were expecting that that's what I was going to do. They didn't know that they had a little rebel on their hands. And my father was an Indian. His mother was an Indian squaw, and so that was, you know, really just me. I grew up loving the outdoors, in the water, and the violin. I loved the violin. I played the violin. My mother used to make me go out in the woods to play it, And I practiced and practiced, and I loved the music. It gave me a feeling on the inside that I couldn't get any other way. I started to go to school, and I did really great. You know, I went to school, and I did all the right things. I was straight A, mostly. I really worked hard to be a good girl until I got 13 years old. And I don't know what the hell happened. I just changed. And I'm watching my little granddaughters now, and they're at that age. I'm like, oh no, here we go again. I just changed, just like overnight. I'd been going to Mutual and Primary and all those things, and hung out with all the religious kids. Everybody thought I was kind of a nerd or whatever. And I liked being that way. And then I started liking boys. And I started running around with the wild kids in school. And I liked that. You know, there was just some sort of excitement that I got out of hanging out with the wild kids and getting chased by the truant officer and drinking during school hours. And that just became a pattern for me. The first drink that I ever had, I was 14 years old, and a girlfriend of mine and some boys from Bear River City went to a party in north of Ogden, and they gave us a bottle of wine, and I drank the bottle of wine, and I liked it. I liked the feeling produced by alcohol. There was just something about it. That night, I passed out twice, not once, but twice. Once in the restroom after I picked a fight with a bunch of girls that were there, and the second time out in the bushes, and they had to come and find me to take me home. I got in a fight, and I just don't even know what I did. I blacked out a lot. When I woke up the next morning, I thought, gee, that I shouldn't be doing that. You know, that's really not for me. That's not something that I should be doing. And I kind of held that feeling for about 2 weeks. And then these same boys, hard telling what they were after, came and got us and took us to a drive-in movie and bought a bottle of gin, and two bottles of party pack. And I learned how to drink out of sacks when I was 14. I drank as much of that bottle as I could get down me, and just created a real hell of a big scene for everybody there. Caused a lot of trouble and made my girlfriend mad at me. And I thought, what is this? You know, why do I do this? Why do I get this alcohol in my hand and act like this? Because I really don't want to do it. Well, that was the pattern for the next 20 years of my life. I liked the party scene. I liked to go out. I loved dancing, but I couldn't dance until I had a few drinks. And, you know, I don't know where I ever got that feeling in me about the bars and what was going on in there, but I loved the smell of them. I liked the people. I still like drunks. And I just loved that scene. I didn't become a solitary drinker until I was a lot older. But I managed in my life to keep on drinking on about a weekly basis until I was married when I was 19 years old. And I thought that if I could get married, then I would probably be happy. And so I went out on one of my alcoholic benders with this alcoholic man and married him. And we didn't get along really very well. And I really wasn't very happy. I'd had some problems. I was raped when I was 16 years old, and it caused me a lot of emotional problems. And I was really having a difficult time dealing with this relationship. But I so wanted to be happy. I wanted to be the way that I saw other people be in my town. And so I thought, if I could have a baby, I'll be happy. And I got pregnant. And I had a little baby girl, and I was afraid of her. She was born, and I just didn't know what to do with her. I didn't drink for a while, but I still didn't know what to do with her. And so the responsibility of that child just absolutely created some problems in me that I didn't have any idea what was going to happen in the end with that. So I drank my way through that marriage for 6 years, and finally I decided that I deserved better than that. And so I got myself a really good job, and I went on a diet, and I divorced him. And I was going to be happy, so then I got married again. And the second guy I married, we were not just on alcohol, but we were on alcohol and everything else we could find. And that didn't last quite as long. The party was over before I expected. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I am not going to get happy that way. I'll just drink. Do you remember Peggy Lee, that song? She used to sing, "If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing." And so I danced my way down to Skid Row. And by then I was really getting big. I weighed about 300 pounds, I think. And I was the queen of the Silver Dollar Saloon. And I would always go to the very worst place I could find to do my drinking, because then I could look down my nose and say, "My God, look at those drunks." And then I could drink, you know, all I could hold. And I held a lot of alcohol. I could drink any man under the table, and did, believe me, a lot. But as luck would have it, and with the personality that I have, and thinking that men were the most important thing, I found another really intelligent guy who had studied journalism at Rutgers University, and he seemed just as handsome. You know, he looked like Dean Martin. And I thought, oh, this is it, this is it. And I married him, and oh my God, he was nuttier than hell. I shouldn't say that, but you know, wherever he is, he's saying the same thing about me. So we had a sort of a stormy relationship, and I guess I should tell you this. We were talking at dinner. You know, tonight, or this weekend, you've got some pretty rowdy speakers. Because I was talking to the other two speakers, and they were saying some of the things they've done. And I really wasn't going to talk about this, but I thought, shoot, I might as well. I'm not as bad as they were. But the way our relationship broke up was one night. He was a bad alcoholic. Oh, shoot. And we were living here in Salt Lake, and I had drank a bottle of sloe gin, and I found out that night that it's not a good idea for me to drink sloe gin. It's the water I drink it with, or the ice, or something, I don't know. But I drank a bottle of sloe gin, and I was heavy, and my husband was really a handsome man, and he started to get mad at me because I kept eating junk food. And so I just got the butcher knife out of the kitchen and went after that sucker. And he was drunker than I was, so I caught him, which was a surprise. And he tried to get the knife away from me, and he couldn't get it away. And in the scuffle, he got his arm cut from elbow to his armpit. And I was horrified. And I really don't remember what happened, but my sister came, And then they came from the hospital and took me and put me in the mental part of Holy Cross, I think it was then. And I was in a cage there for 3 or 4 days. And I cried and cried and cried until I didn't think I could shed another tear. And I thought, what have I done with my life? You know, I had played the violin in the Utah Junior Symphony for 2 years. I had a wonderful family. And here I was in this nut house. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't really know. I thought I was crazy. I guess I was. But my husband didn't press charges. And so I got to go back to Ogden, and I got on welfare. And I went back to school, and I gave up my job. I'd been working for a long time in a supper club. Man, if that wasn't the right place for me, because I could drink all I wanted and eat all I wanted, and I just had a ball. And then there was all these guys out there, you know, that I could pick up. And so I was just having a party there for several years. I worked there about 20 years. And finally my boss said, you know, I can't believe how our liquor bill went down when you quit. That was funny. I tried to make my amends when I got an AA, but he said, nah, forget it. We'll never figure it out. But by then I had really, really gotten to the point where I couldn't really do anything without alcohol. I was capable of staying sober long enough to go do some things once in a while with my daughter, who had gotten, you know, grown up. But my mother took her for me, and she was always taken care of by my mom. And so I just ran the streets. I went to school. And what that really did was give me an excuse to drink more. And I did. I was drinking continually. And they gave me a position. You know, I was pretty alert then, and I was working and learning to be an accountant, and they gave me a job working for the Electrical Workers Union in a one-man office, and I went over there, and my geez, I could hardly, you know, live through the day. And the minute I was off work, it was a half a block to my favorite bar, and there I was. And I swore off every day, and every night they swept me out. I'd drive up to the drive-in window just before they closed and get 2 6-packs of half-quart cans of Ole. And that was what I finished the night with. And I just lived like that for a long time. You know, an amazing thing is that I came to AA and wouldn't admit I was an alcoholic. But that was just the way, and I liked it, you know, and so that was why I kept doing it. My daughter begged me to quit drinking, and I just couldn't. I would, you know, I could quit for a day, maybe 2 days, but I just couldn't stay quit. And I tried everything. I went back and lived with my mother, and I got kicked out of there. I finally found myself a cheap place, and was able to pay the rent there and stay there. But I hung around down on 25th Street, which is a skid row in Ogden, and I didn't have any clothes. I had this mean boyfriend. He's an alcoholic. And he tore up all my clothes and tore the car up. He did something to the car so I couldn't drive the car. But I got these people down on 25th Street to hire me. And so I got a job in my one outfit that I had. And so I worked down there for a long time. And then I got on welfare, too. That was sort of a problem there for a while. I thought I was going to end up in jail. But I had to do something to make ends meet, and I did that clear into my sobriety. That was up into 1970, and in 1970 I was down there in the bars and out of the bars and all over the place. And there was a lot of guys down there, and it was wild. And the winos, you know, people are like, y'all are, a lot of you are scared of winos and the street people, but I'm not. I go to New York and I'm not afraid of those people, because I was part of that crowd. And if I got too drunk, the winos would take care of me, and And I wouldn't even know what I was doing a lot, but they took care of me down there. And, you know, isn't that nice of them to take care of me like that? But I was probably in the worst shape that you can imagine. I don't know how I existed down there. My nickname was Rocky, and that was before Rocky Balboa, so it didn't mean I was tough. It just meant I was mean. And I wasn't afraid of anything, and I took care of myself. And I lasted like that for quite a while, and one day I was in the worst bar on the street where I worked, and in walked this guy, just a little bit taller than I am, and I always like tall, dark, and handsome men, but he's kind of cute. He looked like Neil Diamond, really. Except that he hadn't had a bath for 6 months. His hair was clear down to here, and he had on a pair of cowboy boots. But they didn't have any heels in them. And so, you know, he didn't walk like he was bow-legged. He just walked like there was something, you know, something wrong with him without any heels in those shoes. And he had on a pair of dirty old Levi's. And I was to learn later a jock strap. I didn't know about that then. And a pajama top, and he says that was his shirt. And we had several arguments about that till I took him down to Salvation Army and said, okay, now this is the shirt, this is the pajamas. And he's wearing shirts now. But he had this really curly hair, and he was kind of a ladies' man. But he is obviously a bum. And he... Okay, you've already figured it out, just the kind of guy that I'm going to like, right? And so he walked up and said, do you have a mirror? And I just looked at him. I said, for crying out loud, the whole bar was mirrors. And I said, what do you want? And he says, well, I want to see the back of my hair. And it was all kinky and dirty and matted, you know. And so I said, well, here. So I gave him my mirror, and I guess he went in the bathroom and tried to fix himself up. But anyway, there he was, my knight in shining armor. And his name is Gay, and he's my husband today. And we just celebrated 26 years of sobriety. 25, I mean. Now the story from then that was in 1970, so it took me another 6 months before 9 months before we could get sober. We fought and argued, and you know that guy was really a bum. I'm not kidding. He had been around the United States 3 times on the railroad without a ticket. Now that's a bum, right? And he slept in Salvation Army boxes. He conned everybody in the world out of money. And he was a beggar on the streets like you see now. And when I see people begging for money today, I usually try to give them something. Because they probably want to drink really bad. And anyway, he was mean. He had been married also and was divorced. He says his wife got the inside and he got the outside, and he got mad, and so he just took off, went to Chicago and learned how to be a bum, and rode the rails for 6 years, and he got to Utah and tried to get some welfare from the people here, and they said, well, don't you have a job? And he says, yeah, I'm a sheep herder. And yeah, you know, you got to know this guy. He wouldn't know which end of a sheep was the front and the back. And they says, well, where's your horse? And he says, oh, well, it ran away. And he says, well, where's your saddle? Somebody stole it. And he went through this whole thing, and he tried that 3 times. Finally, last time he got there to Ogden, to the welfare department, this guy told him, he said, you know, I think you better try to get a job. So they gave him a job. He's a painter. and we still today. I was painting with him today. He painted for the welfare office, and they suggested that we might try to straighten out our lives a little bit. But we were having such a good time that we didn't want to do that. And he had been, and the reason I'm telling you this is, it's not my story, it's his, but he had been a bum with this other bum, and they had been all over together, an older fellow named Steve. And one day he was down there at the bar visiting me, and he started home, and he ran into Steve. And Steve had on a suit, and he looked really nice, and at that time he wasn't shaking really hard. And Gay said to him, "What on earth have you done to change like that?" And Steve said, "Well, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous." And so he said, "Why don't you come over there with me?" And so Gay went over there with him, and you know how gossip is on the street? They told me that the reason he went over there was because there was these really cute blonde women. And I hated blondes. I always hated blondes. And there were, but they played bingo, you know, and they really didn't have any. And so I was really jealous, but he wouldn't take me with him. And he went a few times, and he said, "We're going to stop drinking." And I said, "Oh, like hell. You know, we got this party, I've got that, I got this, and so I can't do it right now." And he says, "No, we're going to quit." So he went out and got drunk Saturday night. And I had to work, and I didn't get to get drunk on my last drunk. And you know, I figured for years that I have one coming, right? So we quit, and I'd go to work down there in that bar every day, and I used to have this boyfriend, he'd come in and say, "Well, you got 3 days now." And I'd say, "Yeah," and he'd say, "You want me to buy you a beer?" I'd say, "No, I'm not going to have one today." And I don't know how I did that. You know, I did not believe that there was a God. If there was a God, he sure as heck didn't like somebody that had pulled the stunts that I had. And I didn't believe anything like that. But you know what carried me. Finally, it was February the 14th, and they have a party in Ogden. Or used to call the Washington Birthday Party. And so I got to go to my first AA thing, and I was so excited. And I thought, "Oh, these nice people, you know, what should I wear?" And so should I wear my false eyelashes? Or, you know, I didn't know if to get done up in my bar outfit or some frumpy looking thing for a sober person. And I finally, you know, got ready, and I went down there, and oh God, I was just so shocked, you know, to see all those people. That they were really nice. And so, you know, I told him my name was Patty Reed and his name was Gay Walters and that we were married. And they didn't question me, you know. They just fell for all the crap I told them. And I told them I didn't have a problem, but, you know, my poor sick husband, he really needed help. And so I would go with the Al-Anon ladies. Go down on me. And God, those poor women, you know, they just were so patient with me. And I'd go in there, and you know why I quit? They'd be talking, and they'd say, "Well, this and this and this happened." And I'd think, "My God, if that was me, I'd have done it. I'd be worse." I'd have got drunk sooner. And I just kept identifying with what they were talking about that they had to live with. And I realized, you know, I have got to admit that I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't want the people in AA to know that I was an alcoholic. God, I mean, can you believe? And I told you I was fairly intelligent. But I just, you know, I just had all this stupid false pride and wanted to pretend that I was something other than I was. And it's so funny because a group of old-timers just took us under the wing. The whole group took us in. And they used to talk about us when we weren't there. And they'd say, "Well, Patty needs this worse than he does." And they used to just tease me, you know, and if say, well, maybe you're an alcoholic. And, but I just never would admit it until finally what happened was I had a friend that was in Al-Anon, and her husband and mine went fishing a lot. And so we were alone one weekend, and we were going up the canyon, and there was a bar there. And she said, why don't we just go in and have a drink? And I was scared to death. I knew that if I took a drink, that that would be the end. I knew that. I knew that from the day I got sober. And I said, I can't. I just can't. And she said, well, they aren't going to catch us. And I said, I know that they probably won't. But what about tomorrow? And I knew that if I were to ever pick up a drink, I would never, I would die drunk. And I know that today. That's the only real fear. I got the fear standing in front of all you, but that's the only real fear that I have left today, and that's the fear of drinking. I just don't want to have to die a drunk. After that happened, I'd go to the meetings and I'd say things like, I'm Patty and I'm an alcoholic and I'm a drug addict and I'm a compulsive overeater and a member of Al-Anon. You know, and it's like, you know, and everybody would just look at me like, what the hell did she say? And but that's just, you know, it was like I just didn't want to say that. And but, you know, the funny thing about it was we'd go to these parties. They always had these house parties, and all the guys would be in there talking about AA, and all the women would be in there talking about recipes and kids and dresses and all that crap. And I'd be sitting over there on the chair leaning over, you know, trying to hear what those guys were talking about, and they'd ask me a question, and I couldn't answer them. And finally, I just got so I got to go over with the guys and talk about AA. And that's still my favorite thing to do. You know, if there's any AA people around, I just love to sit and talk about AA. I don't care if we're talking about newcomers or each other. I call that loving appraisal. I learned that in Hawaii. and or service. I love service, and I just love this program. You know, when I first got here, I thought there's something different about this program than all the other things that I had tried. And believe me, I had tried. I had a lot of opportunities and different things that people would try to give me, books about self-help things. And I can't even remember Psycho-Cybernetics. I remember that one. But I never made it clear through the whole book. You know, I couldn't do all that stuff they wanted you to do. And I got into Alcoholics, I was sort of sitting on the outskirts and reading about the 12 steps. And I began to listen to the old timers, and they were talking about what happened to them. And I realized that from the time that I was 13 years old until I was 33 years old, what had happened to me is that I had a good life, a clean life, and a happy life that my higher power had put there for me. And I had turned that into a dirty shambles with alcohol and my self-will and the things that I had to do to get to where I was. And how I did that was by changing my personality. And so when I came in the doors here, I was a woman that was driven by anger, hate, and fear. And there was nothing I could do about it. I had books about overcoming depression and overcoming fear and overcoming anger, but I couldn't overcome them. And I never realized that if I'd stopped drinking, maybe I could. And you know, I didn't tell you, but I was like in and out of the nut house all the time while I was drinking. They'd put me in there for one reason or another, and I was in there about six times. And I really thought I was just nuts. Is what I thought was wrong. But the amazing thing is I have never been back to the hospital since I quit drinking for that. I've been back a lot. But I could see by being in the meetings and listening to people that the solution to our problems was in the 12 steps. And so I wanted to learn more about them. And it's really hard when you're not an alcoholic. You have to sneak to read the big book. And I got me a 12 by 12, and I found some nutty guy there in town that was trying to help me, and I finally had admitted I was an alcoholic, and I had a heck of a time with the second step because I just didn't know about this higher power. I thought that God was, you know, really upset about the way I was acting, and so I had a hard time accepting the higher power, or thinking he'd accept me. But I finally did, and I got to the third step. And they told me to read the third step in the 12 by 12 and read it for 30 days. And so, God, I walked around for 30 days with that book under my arm, preaching to God about how I was turning my life over to him. And, you know, if you stop and think about it, if you just think those words, God knows it. So I just wasted, he's probably thinking, all right, already. But I did start working the 12 steps, and I got to the third step. But, you know, I was sober, and I did a four step. I got to tell you how I did my first four step. There was this nun in Ogden, and she is a friend of mine. And I don't ask me how I got a friend that was a nun. It's a long story. But I says, I'm going to do this fourth step. And she says, okay, I'm going to listen, you know. And she's really nice. And so I got to 13 on my inventory, and she was saying, you didn't do that. And I was like, yeah, I did. And so I got to 14 and I started lying. And she was going, and when I'd say something, she'd go, hee, like that. And she just thought that was funny, those things that I did. And she told me several years after that, she says, I always wish that I could have done some things that you did. But anyhow, I just lied and lied through my fourth step. And you know how it says, I never told you that, did I, Bonnie? I got to the fifth step, and it says, we walked away a free man. And I didn't. I just didn't. And I had secrets, primarily the one I told you tonight, and a lot of others, a lot of others. And so my recovery showed that. But I still kept trying to work the steps. And today, when I see newcomers and they're working on the steps, I know that they're doing the very best, and that's what it says in the big book, that we do the best that we can. We accept spiritual progress, not perfection. And thank God for that, because I was 8 years sober before somebody finally cracked that big shell that I had built up around myself. And it was some guy, I went to a retreat up in the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming, and there was a guy there that was an ex-mafia guy, and he was a psychologist and a lawyer and mean, and he had done all this really rotten stuff. And so we had this four-step meeting, and it went on into the till it was getting daylight outside. And it took that particular place and time and that person who was worse than I was. You know, I always want, I want to be better than I am, and I had enough confidence, and it was like you could almost see me fall apart in front of that, you know. And I loved that guy, and it was the first time in my life I could ever say that I loved a man and I didn't want to get in the sack with him. And then after a while he says, well, maybe if Gay wants to get rid of you, we can get married. But Gay didn't want to get rid of me, so I didn't. But, you know, that man really saved my life. He did a lot of things for me. He taught me how to work the steps. And I don't believe in men sponsoring women, but he lived in California, and I lived in Utah, so Gay said it was all right. And because he wouldn't take my lies. I told him about that incident with John and the knife, and he said, have you made amends to him? And I said, me make amends? It was his fault. And he just looked at me and got on the plane and didn't say anything. And finally I realized I had to make amends, and I did. I made amends to John. The day I realized it, I saw him in the store and I was shaken inside. And the man had frozen both of his feet off. He was a wino on 25th Street. And he was in really, he was, you know, wet brain. And I saw him and I was scared to death. I was just shaken and I left. And then I realized, it was like a bucket of cold water was thrown on me, and I realized, I have got to tell that man I'm sorry. You know, I ruined his life. And I really hurt him. You know, so what if he was an alcoholic and did all those things to me? Like tease me because I was fat and all that mean stuff. So I started looking for him down on 25th Street. And, you know, he was all dirty and beat up and everything. And I'd go to these strangers, are you John? This one guy one day says, I'm not John, lady, but I can be. Oh. But I tried to find him and tried to find him. And I couldn't find him until one day I found out that he was in a rest home just down the street from our Alano Club. And so I packed up my husband and several of his old crony friends, and we went down to see John and took him a big book and a 12 by 12 and I think some other literature. And he quietly informed us he wasn't a joiner, and so he wasn't interested. But Gay and I together went to visit him a few times, and I went by myself and visited him. And I don't know where he is today. I think he's probably dead. But, you know, I was really glad to get to know that man. He was a really kind-hearted fellow. And when he was in that hospital, he couldn't drink. And besides that, they had him sedated. And so I did get to know him and apologize to him. I was able to apologize to my first husband. I also apologized to my second husband. So far as I know, they're all dead of alcoholism today. And I'm sorry, you know, for that. I wish that I could have learned what I learned in the 70s, in the 50s, but I didn't, and they didn't. And they're there as an example for those of us that are here today, I think, to know. I told you about my little girl, and she grew up, she didn't drink, she was just like I was, a good little girl, and when she was when she was 16 years old, she started drinking really heavily. She also got into drugs, and she just got wiped right out. The first time I saw her that I know of that she was drinking, she came in the house, she was a gorgeous girl, and we had to put her in the tub because she couldn't even walk. She had a fur coat on, and she was just, we tried to find the car that she had gotten out of because they had done something. She was way mixed up. But anyway, that started her. I was sober now, and she was drinking, and she used drugs. And she started to have the same kind of mental problems that I did. So she would go to psychiatrists. And then in 1978, she got herself into a wreck. She had a 280Z or some fast car, and she drove it into some other car. Was picked up for drunk driving, and we put her into the hospital for alcohol rehabilitation. And she went through the program, and she was sober, and she was with us and all the old-timers, and we had a good time. We used to go to all the area assemblies in southern Utah, and we took her with us, and that was in 1978. She was just such a cute girl, and she was happy. She loved being sober, and she wanted to live a life like mine. She had learned to be proud of me. She hated me when I got here, but she knew she wanted what I had. And so we went on like that for a while, and then she got married to her childhood sweetheart and had two adorable little girls. And I just, you know, I really, when I got here, didn't have the slightest idea how to love. I took hostages, or, you know, I just didn't know what love was. But when those babies were born, I did. And I just would have done anything for those children. But she kept having trouble. She had trouble when her first daughter was born, and so I had to take care of her because she was on morphine. And so she would get off of alcohol and drugs and everything. And then she would go because she would be depressed, and they would put her on medication, and she would get on medication, start abusing it, get on street drugs, and then start drinking again. And that went on and on and on. And, you know, I don't know how I lived through those years. Because I was happy, and I had everything going for me. And that girl tried really hard, but she just couldn't figure it out. And on August the 6th, 1994, my little granddaughter called me, and she says, "Grandma, come over here. Mama's dead." And I said, "Kara, don't joke." She says, "Grandma, hurry, because the police are here." And I don't even know how I got over there, but I got over there. And when I pulled in, the people were, the paramedics were bringing this body out with a blue thing over it. And that was Patty Lynn. And I just didn't know. Could this happen? And I can remember saying, "Why didn't you tell me it was going to be today?" I'd known that that was going to happen. And I fell down, and it was just, I guess shock or something. And right, all those doctor people came running over and, "Can we give you some Valium?" And I, God, you know, Rocky's back. I said, "For crying out loud, that's what caused this problem in the first place. No, I don't want your damn stuff." And they were trying to pick me up. I said, "Just get the hell out of here. Let me stand up." And I was angry. And I went in her house after everybody left, and my husband and I threw out everything in there for some reason. But we kept a file cabinet that was made out of cardboard and some things for the children to remember their mother by. The house had all kinds of drug stuff and alcohol and just everything in there. And it was filthy. And so we just threw it all out. And that was the end of her life. And I thought that I was just going to die. I thought, "God, why couldn't you have just let me go? I'm not healthy. And I could go and she could have my sobriety." But you know, that's not the way this program works. The way this program works is that we all have to learn how to do it ourselves. And I, it was a year after, and I went through the cabinet that she had left and looked at her papers. And in her papers it says, "Well, I'm going to do this and this and this, and I'm going to do that to stay sober, and I'm going to do this just like my mom does, and I'm going to have parties and invite the friends and people over so that I can have a happy life like my mom." And what was wrong? You know, why couldn't she do that? And, you know, the first time I went to an AA meeting, I was at my home group. It's a Sunday morning serenity group in Ogden. And I was sitting there, and they read the fifth chapter. And it was like they were screaming the words in there to me. There are people who just don't understand. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. And I realized that that child had been born that way. And her other problem I know now is because she never understood the 11th step prayer, the prayer of St. Francis, where we learn to give rather than take. She always wanted to get it, and she didn't know all she had to do was give to get it. I still miss her a lot, but you know, I feel her presence sometimes. That might sound weird, but after we had a memorial service for her, and they were talking about who was going to be the speakers, and her favorite boyfriend got to be the speaker, and he did a good job. And I said, you know, I don't know what I can do, but I want to say something for Lynn, Patty Lynn. And so I sit there by myself in the middle of the night, and there was a presence in that room, and I know today it was my higher power. And I was able to write for her some things to her, the people she loved. And she was such a sweetheart. And to leave a message for her girls. And you know, and so it's okay. I had to let go of her. And you know, when I was able to do that, something happened to me. I'm stronger today than when she was alive. I'm not happy that she's gone, but I'm happier today. And that girl has given my whole life a whole different meaning. There isn't anything that I wouldn't do for the new person that comes in, but I can't give you this program. And today I know that. And I didn't used to really know that. She's one of those people who had to die so that we can live. I didn't understand that. I said it. Today I understand it, and I mean it, and I'm happy that I can share this story with you. Sometimes at first I couldn't even hardly say it, but today I can, because I think we need to know how serious this problem is that we have. She was the third generation to die of alcoholism, and there was just no other way her life could have been. She couldn't have gone on the way she was. And I'm comfortable with that today. And I thought, oh, my life is never going to be okay again. And you know what? It's really funny because after I was able to let go of her, I enjoyed her more. We never got to make amends because we were always fighting because one or the other of us was drunk. And so I've been a lot happier. And I think that she's forgiven me, and I think God has forgiven both of us. You know, that doesn't mean that my life is all rosy. I am happy, but I have some problems. You know, I'm married to the meanest son of a gun, and he won't give me my own way most of the time, and never enough money. I hate to get so serious. I got to tell you some of the funny stuff. I almost forgot. But I want to tell you this one thing. You know, my husband was rough and mean, and so was I guess. But I always, you know, wanted this romantic guy that was going to just be real romantic and everything, and I got this mean old guy instead. And well, you know, his idea of foreplay, I know I'm not supposed to talk about sex, but I got to tell you this. As he walks in the bedroom door, leans against the gym and says, "All right, Patty, brace yourself." I just love to tell that because it makes him so mad. He says, "Oh, I don't even." But anyhow, you know, it's really funny because that's, honest to God, that's the truth. He called foreplay foul play. But one thing I wanted to tell you about, you know, I told you that he had left his family. His mother was murdered when he was 9 years old, and he went to live with his brother. And he left Michigan, and he was a missing person. Now, I thought that, but I didn't know it, and he doesn't talk much. And so he had those three kids that had never seen him since they were little, and his sisters and brothers hadn't seen him since 1958. And we have a friend that's in Alcoholics Anonymous that's a writer. Used to be the general service office manager, and he writes a lot for different magazines and things. And he was so intrigued about my husband and my story that he wrote it about it in a magazine. And it wasn't about alcoholism, and it wasn't about AA, and so he mentioned Gay's name, and he also mentioned the fact that he lived in Ogden, Utah. And we knew the article was written. It started out to be a book. We knew it was written and put into this magazine, or that it was going to be put in a magazine, but we didn't know that it was. And the phone rang one day, and this lady says, is this the Gay Walters residence? And I said, yes. And she says, well, this is his sister. And I says, oh, yeah? I thought it was one of them blondes again, you know. And I just laughed at her, and she just started crying and just went nuts. And that was his sister that he had, and brother that he had gone to live with when his mother died. And so they found him. And there was, oh my God, we had like $600 phone bills, the whole family. He had 8 brothers and sisters and 3 children. And I'm telling you, our life, this happened a year ago, and honest to God, it might have been a year ago today. It was that close. And our life absolutely turned around. We didn't have any kids. We were like orphans. We had all the AA kids, but, you know, we didn't have a family. Now we got all these Walters people running around driving me nuts. And they had this big family reunion in Michigan, and so we went, and you know, I just couldn't help it. But I had to tell all of those guys about Gay and the brace yourself bit. And you know, every one of those women said the same thing. So if you're looking for a romantic guy, don't look at those guys, I'll tell you that. And we've had such a good time, they'll call our house, and that's how they'll start out. And one of them lives in Texas, and she says, brace yourself, that Texas accent. And we've just got the biggest kick out of his family. I got to meet his daughter, came and spent a week with us, and we got to celebrate her birthday. We had Thanksgiving and Christmas and her birthday and Easter and Valentine's Day all wrapped up in one. And I gave her a cupcake for every year Dad had been gone. And I gave her a Valentine that said something about, here's a kiss, and he gave her some kisses for all the years that I was blitzed. And we just had a good time with her. She's a nice, nice girl. She's not an alcoholic, and she's so nice, I don't hardly know how to act around her. He told me I couldn't swear, and I did, and she's accepted it. And his and his son is, I kind of have a little speech impediment, and I like to call him Rerun, but Gay says don't, because you can't tell it sounds funny the way you say it. But, you know, Rerun is about what he is. When we found him, he was on a run and involved in drugs and alcohol. He's been a poly drug user since he was 11 years old. And he was so hurt by his father leaving him. And he's still a little bit mad at him about it. But you know what? That kid has got 9 months of sobriety. And he's over there in Colorado. Don P's helping him right now. And hopefully he's going to stay out of jail. But if he's going to go, he's going to go, and I think he can accept it. And his youngest son lives in Florida, and my luck, I got to go down to Florida and meet him this summer. And, you know, it was like going back in time. there was the same kid that I met, you know, 25 years ago. And just a charming kid, curly black hair, only it was clean. And we're just waiting for him to come and see us, or so that we can get to see him. Gay hasn't seen him yet. But my God, what a life. You know, look what God has done for us that we couldn't do for ourselves. And it took 25 years for that to happen. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you hear the phrase, don't give up until the miracle happens. And you know what? You know a story about that now, today. I told you that I came into the program full of anger, hate, and fear. I believe that the 12 steps have taught me love. The first three steps taught me how to love God. The next six steps taught me to love myself. And the last three steps taught me to love y'all. And you know, for me to stand here in front of a room full of women and say that I love you is really something. But I do. I used to didn't like women because they never drank enough for me. And they got most of the good-looking guys. I wasn't hanging around the right crowd, was I? Well, you know, I'm really sorry because I didn't tell you all my jokes. And I do believe that my time is up. But I do want to thank, you know, I want to thank all of you for being here and listening to me tonight and let me share my life with you. I appreciate your gift. And to the committee and to Marcy and all of you that put all the work into this, I just want you to know that I'm really, really grateful for this opportunity. I hope you all have a good weekend, and I wish you freedom from anger, hate, and fear.